turns out I actually made a contradiction. I do have a financial disclosure to make, and that is that I do frequent consulting for the Department of Health and Mental Hygiene, the Medicaid Authority in Maryland, and the data that I'm going to be talking about today is based on that, and since I'm going to be reporting about the program, even though I work for a not-for-profit, I should disclose that to you. What I'm going to be talking about today is cervical cancer screening and gynecologic visit rates for Medicaid enrollees, that is the main program in the United States for low-income folks and disabled folks, for Medicaid enrollees with mental health and substance use disorders. So what this talk is really about is looking at issues related to integrating somatic care, physical care, with mental health and substance abuse care. So other than my connection with the DHMH as a frequent consultant, I have no other financial disclosures to make. So let me begin actually with a connection to Ken Letterman, because what I'm going to try to do in the next few slides is to persuade you of the importance of connecting mental health and substance use issues to somatic care issues. So either to persuade you or to remind you of the importance of that if you already know about it. So there's a lot of data that's been generated over the past many years, recently summarized by the National Academy of State Mental Health Policy. Can you see the, is the pointer visible? Good. The NASHB, underneath NASHB is a group called the National Research Institute, and Ted Letterman is the head of that and has been for several years. That, I was told by Gene, is Ken's son. So even though I never had a chance to meet Ken, I'm pleased that I know his son's work quite well, and I look forward to someday meeting him too. But this work has demonstrated that there's significant mortality differences between people with severe mental illness. They live 25 years less, according to NASHBID, this NASHBID report in 2006, than the general population. Pretty substantial hit, something that certainly healthcare professionals need to pay attention to and are paying attention to. In studies that have looked at doing various obvious adjustments, age, smoking, physical activity adjustments, in this Scottish study, national a study from the United Kingdom, where they took a look at mortality of individuals who had an inpatient psychiatric event versus individuals who had other inpatient events, and found that their mortality was still, that is, those with mental illness was still twofold higher than those with other types of somatic conditions, even after you adjust for these obvious things. So something else is obviously going on. Finally, on this slide, I cite the work of Ben Druss and colleagues, who've done a lot of work looking at medical care disparities between folks with mental illness and others. And in particular, suggest that if you're interested in this, you have a look at his 2001 report, where they looked at myocardial infarction treatment follow-ups and found that mortality was higher in individuals with severe mental illness, serious mental illness. But those differences between control groups went away if you adjusted for quality measures. So the strong suggestion of that work from 2001 is that medical care quality issues are a big driver in terms of increased death rates in individuals with severe mental illness. Pretty striking finding, I think. Let me read this to you. High-quality health systems work to bridge the many gaps between mental health care and substance abuse treatment and primary medical care. So this integration idea, and these words I put at the top of the slide, fragmentation, disintegration, discoordination, I dare say are the most frequently cited words or parts of those words, integration, coordination, when you talk about health care today, whether you're talking about access, quality, or cost. You know, people talk about, if you could just get people to work together, get things to work together, things would happen. This is a statement that was proffered by the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill, leading advocacy group for people with mental illness. This is the goal, right? They're calling for more integration, okay? So don't take my word for it. This is a leading national advocacy group that's saying this. And in that same report, they said this in reference to holistic care, or where we are now. States are not focusing on wellness and survival for people with serious mental illness, okay? So big gap that they're pointing out. And in this report, it's actually a nice report. It's called Grading the States. You can get it online. They did a report in 2006 and a follow-up in 2009. It's quite comprehensive. In there, they offer several areas of focus in order to address why survival rates for people with severe mental illness are lower than they should be. And the one that I'm going to be focusing on is this last bullet, okay? Too much separation of mental and physical health care services, all right? These other ones get quite a lot of discussion already, and arguably, of course, injury and suicide are related directly to mental illness. So what I'm going to be talking about specifically with regard to cervical cancer screening is that final bullet there. Another way people talk about this integration or holistic care, of course, is with the term person-centered care. National experts from the Institute of Medicine, social scientists, and clinicians have proffered this as being important for the treatment of patients with and individuals with severe mental illness. And then the National Council for the Community Behavioral Health Care, this is a group that represents providers, mostly not-for-profit providers, community mental health centers, et cetera, that treat individuals with mental health care. And the reason I cite them in particular is because prominently in their 2009 report by Barbara Maurer, the mention of preventative services as being an important point to focus upon with regard to increased mortality that we see in morbidity, and also the focus on women's issues in particular. Some other reasons why we care about women's health, in particular with regard to mental illness, are quickly summarized on this slide. Sexual abuse rates are not only known antecedents to mental illness, but also they have their own problems that go along with them that spill over into the somatic side. Substance use disorder, of course, is a comorbidity to all individuals with mental illness and serious mental illness, especially. Low income is a correlate to women with mental illness, and actually this reference that I'm providing here also talks about the fact that women with serious mental illness have higher rates of just physical disability compared to men with similar mental health morbidity. And then, of course, there's the distinctive biology or distinctive anatomy. Of course, men have small risk of breast cancer, but it's not common at all. And then, of course, the focus of this presentation is cervical cancer screening. And the references that I provide here are various studies that have actually looked at rates of screening, either mammography in that top bullet or cervical cancer screening in the bottom bullet, and have identified what they believe are disparities in terms of individuals with mental illness generally or frequently persons with serious mental illness having lower rates of preventative screening than control groups. Okay, so what I want to do in this presentation is describe to you how I looked at that question through a single population, Maryland Medicaid. Okay, so again, medical assistance. These are poor and low-income women, in particular that I looked at, and I asked the following question: are in Maryland Medicaid are women with severe mental illness and or substance use disorder receiving cervical cancer screening rates comparable to other women in that Medicaid program? It's important to look at Medicaid in large part because if you look at like the work of Richard Frank and Sherry Gleed, if you're familiar with their nice volume, Better But Not Well, you know that the Medicaid system in this country is often characterized as the de facto mental health system, especially for people with severe mental illness. So the Medicaid population is important to look at for severe mental illness. Alternative outcomes and related outcomes that I look at in additional cervical cancer screening are GYN visits, okay, because that seemed hopefully, and to you as well, seems obviously relevant. And then in sort of epi fashion, I take a look at genital cancer rates, and this, because of the way the Medicaid data is coded, I consider any kind of cancer, cervical, vaginal, ovarian, or unspecified. They're very rare rates, but I wanted to look at cancer rates as well, so I do that, and I'll present that to you. Okay, so what did I do? I took Maryland Medicaid claims data, transactional data that relates to payment, and which I work with all the time at the Hilltop Institute, and I started with a sample from 2004-2005. The entire population in that year was just over 800,000. I removed all the men, just over 494,000. I isolated it to people with full enrollment, full engagement in the Medicaid program, 12 months, just so that I would know I would have as complete a medical record as possible, still a pretty good sample at 300,000. I then isolated it to the age appropriate for cervical cancer screening, pretty appropriate. These are sexually active women, up until around age 65, but it could be later than that as well. But this age constraint is also related to the Medicaid program covering principally women under the age of 65. I excluded pregnant women so as to focus on primary prevention. I didn't want to pick up screening events that were related to the fact that a woman was already getting attention from an OBGYN. Okay, and I ended up with an effective sample size of 105,000. Okay, so pretty good and pretty complete, I think. Now, don't be frightened by this slide. It's a lot of numbers. I'm going to spend a little bit of time on it. But if you're really good at speed reading tables, you could, and you were a policymaker and quick to judgment, you might say, voila, here's the answer. Okay, well, before I go to that and before I tell you why it's not the answer, I'm going to use this slide as a moment to describe to you how I actually define my populations. Okay, so Maryland Medicaid data from 2004, 2005, as I said. I looked in there for ICD-9 diagnostic codes, which are connected to most of the claims, most of the transactions when they go to see the doctor. And based on those codes, I flagged individuals who had psychosis. This is principally schizophrenia, but might include some other related ICD-9 codes like delusional disorder. So ICD-9, 295, 297, 298 for any of you who think in numbers. But principally schizophrenia, psychosis, individuals were flagged, or if they had substance use disorder or any indication of substance use disorder, so this could even be a drug-induced delirium event or something would get them into this group. If they had both of those, they would have been put in a group here. And then if they didn't have psychosis or substance use disorder, but they had bipolar disorder or depression, because it's so prevalent, and because it's quite serious, I wanted to have a look at that group as well. And then finally, and you can argue that maybe this is too large a group, but finally, all other women were placed in a control group. There's your numbers. Obviously, I'm heavily weighted into this group, this control group, 91,000, but I have at least 1,000 individuals in each of the other groups. Now, your policymaker, you might say, all right, Michael, you know, give me the numbers. Tell me who has higher rates of cervical cancer screening and who doesn't. Let's jump to the bottom of the table. Let's take a look at the controls, okay? 19%. Now, this is, for those of you who know a lot about cervical cancer screening, you know then that according to the U.S. Preventive Task Force, if you're a sexually active woman, you should get screening every 2 or 3 years, okay? Remember, this is one-year prevalence data that I'm showing you, so that really could be translated to about 60% or just under 60% of the women over a three-year period might be getting cervical cancer screening in my control group. That's actually not too far off from standard data that we might see in a population like this. A little bit low, but it's not too far off. Of course, you'd like it to be closer to 100%, but that's where it is. But so you might come to the conclusion here that, okay, 19% in the control group. All of my diagnostic groups have higher rates of screening. Hey, Maryland Medicaid is doing a great job relative to controls, right? You might also then, let's look at GYN visits. 28% of the controls go to the gynecologist. Hey, look at all these rates, much higher. Good going, Maryland Medicaid, right? Looking at the cancer rates, there's rare event. I'm cautioning you against over-interpreting this result. But here, the rates are a little bit the opposite effect, okay? You could argue, maybe there's an issue with higher rates of cancer. Maybe it's even tied, in fact, to the higher rates of screening. Okay, before you do that, though, if you've been looking at the rest of my table, then you notice that there are some significant confounders in here. Most notably, the age difference is quite large. Okay, Medicaid serves lots of pregnant women. It's one of the key ways that you enter Medicaid. We care in this country about women and children. We care less about men who don't have children and about women who haven't gotten pregnant before. Okay, that's just the way it works. It's changing with healthcare reform, by the way, but that's the way it was working in 2004 and 2005. So that's one, age is a confound. There are some racial differences. I'm not going to get into that other than to say to you, I realize that racial disparities exist, so I will control for it in the regressions that I'm going to show you. There are some differences. Baltimore City is the biggest urban center, so I'm also going to try to control for regional differences that might get at urban-rural dichotomies that might influence this because of things like supply of GYNs, for example, are more prevalent in the cities. I also have considered whether or not they're the individuals I'm looking at are disabled or not, and actually that's a big difference. The controls are not typically disabled, but all of these mental disorders are a very common pathway to get into long-term or short-term disability from the state side. So there's differences there that I'm going to adjust for. And then finally, I'm going to adjust for the presence or absence of sexually transmitted diseases, HIV, looking at that separately, and HPV, for those of you who know about cervical cancer screening, is a big risk factor for cervical cancer. So I'm going to adjust for that too. So this isn't the answer. The way that I try to get at the answer is with logistic regression. For those of you who don't like statistics much, this really isn't that complicated. I'm going to try to quickly tell you what's going on here. I have a simple equation. On the left-hand side of my equation, my dependent variable is a 1 or a 0. Did they get screening or didn't they? And then I do two other regressions, 1 or 0. Did they get gyn visits or didn't they? Did they have cancer or didn't they? And the logistic regression is just a way to deal with a binary outcome like that. The right-hand side, the independent variables in my equation, are flags for various diagnoses. Did they have psychosis? 1 or 0. Substance use disorder? 1 or 0. And by the way, for those of you who think about comorbidities, if they had both, they'd get 1s in both of these, okay? Bipolar depression would be a mutually exclusive category, so if they had 1 here, it wouldn't be anywhere else. And similarly with controls, if they're a control, there's not a 1 anywhere else. So those are the variables I care about. Those are my main effects in this regression. I have an age, a polynomial for age, which just means I can look at a curvilinear relationship, but I'm going to look at age differences or adjust for age differences, racial differences. Medicaid eligibility, as I briefly described to you, is a proxy for disability status more than anything, but also a little bit for outcome. Geographic region, again, this urban-rural divide, and then sexually transmitted diseases. Okay, so let's jump right to the answers. Now, you're the policymaker, and I'm going to tell you, hey, this is the real answer. Okay, I've adjusted. What you're looking at here on this slide are the actual fits of the regression, so you can see my models. Each outcome is a single column. So this is genital cancer. I predict about 9% of the variance. Not bad, but that means 91% I can't explain, right? So his cup is more than half empty, but not bad for these kinds of regressions. And 23% and 14%. So that's what that information is about. And then below you have confidence intervals and 95% confidence intervals and point estimates, which tell you about the odds of receiving either having cancer or of receiving one of the two screenings. And the stars show you what's significant. My cancer effects are not. So summary is there that diagnosis is not related to having a genital cancer, in this case for women. However, the magnitude as well as the direction and the significance of the effects are similar for both of my other two key outcomes, the ones I really care about, the screening outcomes, the preventative care outcomes, the social justice outcomes. Okay, we'll make that connection. And for example, here's how I interpret that, simple as this. This coefficient here says that for individuals who have psychosis versus controls, they're 35% more likely, that's a good thing, more likely to receive cervical cancer screening than controls after you've adjusted for all the other effects in my model. Good thing. Similarly, good things going on for gyn visits. Good things going on for the bipolar depression group as well. They have increased odds of receiving these preventative screening. The one group that doesn't do well are the substance use group, okay? They have lower odds of receiving screening or of going to the gynecologist, okay? This is just a brief slide. How am I doing on time here? Okay. This is a brief slide just to tell you I did some sensitivity analysis statistically. As I told you, if somebody has both psychosis and substance use disorder, I flagged them in both cases, which means that in my main model, for those of you who are statistically inclined, I actually allowed the same person to contribute to both slope coefficients. However, another way you could do it is you could do mutually exclusive groups where I actually create a separate group that's substance use and psychosis together, and I create a separate coefficient point estimate for that. I did that. The results were similar. No suggestion of an interaction. And then I did a statistical interaction as well, which is where you multiply these two coefficients together. Subtle difference, but no huge differences. Nothing suggesting that there was a synergy between psychosis and substance use. Everything pointed only to substance use being the problem. Now, several of the covariates were significant. I'm not going to go into detail of that, but if anybody's interested, I certainly can share with you our draft manuscript and or whatever you're interested in terms of seeing those. But suffice it to say that things you might expect, like age, loaded in significantly, and there were significant racial effects, although one's demonstrating that African Americans actually had higher rates of screening than whites, so that was a little bit surprising. But remember, we're adjusting for urban-rural effects and other things as well, and Maryland Medicaid has a lot of African Americans in it, especially in Baltimore City, so it tends to have pretty good coverage for some of these preventative issues, so I'm not that surprised by that. But in any case, if you're interested in any of the other covariate effects, I'm happy to share those with you. But the main punchline is that if you have substance use disorder specifically as a behavioral health diagnosis, you're at risk for not receiving screening in comparable rates compared to other populations. Now, my second to the last slide here is actually a little bit complicated. It keeps confusing me. It keeps confusing my co-authors. So I'm going to try to focus your attention on it because the essence of it is actually quite simple. Let's just look at this last column here, okay? What I'm describing here is essentially the correlation between receiving cervical cancer screening and visiting the gynecologist, okay? Nothing very nuanced medically about that, okay? Gynecologists are the principal deliverers of PAP screening, cervical cancer screening. And what this is showing is that of 21,000 individuals with gyn visits, okay, GYN visits, 14,000 of them in my population, 70%, receive cervical cancer screening. Compare that to individuals without GYN visits, okay? 80,000 people without GYN visits, only 5,000, 6.5%, received cervical cancer screening. So you don't have to be a computer or a statistical genius to know that the chi-squared there is going to be gigantic, and it is. I've reported it there down below, perhaps out of a little bit of obsession, OCD behavior. But this is a clear and perhaps obvious correlate, but an important correlate, suggesting that, you know, get women to the gynecologist, especially for, in this case, routine visits. There's no symptomology that brought them to the doctor, according to the Medicaid record. And you're going to increase their likelihood that they're going to get this important preventative screen that could save their life, okay, cervical cancer screening. These other two columns, which I won't leave up here, but if you're interested later, you can look at the slides or email me, I'll send them to you, is if we looked at symptomatic visits or if we looked at any GYN visit, okay, as opposed to just routine ones. Still see a similar effect, but it's not quite as strong. So you want to get people to the primary care doc. In this case, the primary care doc for GYN issues is an OBGYN expert. Okay. So take-home messages. Substance use disorder presents as a major and singular risk factor for missing an important preventative screen, cervical cancer screening. This replicates in a way our previous work, which is now in press in Osteoporosis International, where we looked at a subset of the same population, older, to see if they were getting bone density screenings appropriately. And we saw the same sort of effect. Women with substance use disorder were uniquely at risk compared to the other groups for not receiving bone density screening. Our analysis, we think, suggests that Maryland Medicaid seems to be at least adequately, remember I told you the rates overall were a little bit lower than national averages, but adequately screening for cervical cancer in women with severe mental illness. This may be tied, I'm speculating here, but the NAMI report that I cited at the beginning on grading the states. Gave Maryland a pretty good grade, one of the highest. It was like a B minus or something like that. No, I don't think any states got an A, but it was one of the top four states. So Maryland's a fairly wealthy state. Medicaid program runs fairly well comparatively, and we may be seeing, you know, idiosyncratic results in Maryland because of that. Good for Maryland. It also speaks to the limitations of my work and the generalizability of our work here. As I tried to show you on the last slide was gynecologic access, an obvious but an important correlate for policymakers to think about changing, trying to increase supplies of OBGYN experts or getting more women to their routine visits. The limitations are that, again, this Maryland Medicaid population, low income, disabled, in a fairly wealthy state with a good mental health program. Women with full enrollment, which I think is okay for this first comparison, but high percentages of women in Medicaid, especially earlier in their lives before they become disabled, say if they have mental illness, churn in and out of the program, so they don't have 12 months of eligibility. Remember, I dropped well over 100,000 women that fell into that category to focus on people for whom I had full medical records. And even though I had, you know, pretty good sample size, remember, my biggest group was that control group at 90,000. So the other groups were not tremendously large, and there's some small samples when you get into subgroups with logistic regression. And all this work, if it wasn't obvious, this is single-year prevalence. So I don't know if I don't know for sure that the mental illness preceded, for example, the event of screening. But you know, mental illness, chronic disease, and these folks are 18 years old. Mental illness often begins in late adolescence. So there's a good chance that, in this case, it was a reasonable design. So that's it. Thanks for hanging out.
Well, thanks, Michael. I have to say I'm really excited about these data, even though I know you say, oh, it's kind of what we expect, right? We expect people that go to the doctor to get the screened. But we're doing this in Denver, as you know, at our mental health center. We're putting a primary care provider into a mental health center, and we say, well, you know, they're going to get screened. Well, now we know they're going to get screened because the doctor's there. They have access. So, you know, it's you know, it sounds simple, but we're basing our programs on this. So I wish that we'd had more people here. I think this was an excellent panel. I mean, lots of interesting information, both in terms of how do we measure things, how do we provide services, and then how do we know that we're going to have to get more access for primary care for our consumers. So we have time to take a few questions. Yes. Okay.
Okay. Well, it's electroconvulsive therapy, and it's producing an electric current that's passed through the head that causes the person to have a convulsion. So it's a quasi-surgical procedure with anesthesia. Now, how it works, they don't really know. No, they don't.
So you feel it's very effective?
Well, it's very effective for me and for many people. I've asked my psychiatrist whether my experience is an unusual one, and she says absolutely not, that she sees miracles every day with ECT. It may work because it alters the chemicals in the brain, just like you would hope medications would do, something about serotonin and stuff that you guys in the mental health field know all about.
Do you still need to take medication?
I take 3 less antidepressants, but I still take half a dose of trazodone, yeah. Yeah, and no depression.
But you think it's underutilized because of the cost, the minority?
I think it's cost because Medicaid, and because Medicaid doesn't cover it, and I think it's also attitudes. Psychiatrists who weren't trained in ECT, who have no knowledge about it, or who have archaic beliefs about it, are not going to refer for it.
Well, Melissa, you have a life book.
Sorry. My name is Rohini. Melissa couldn't be here.
Sorry.
Thank you.
Okay. Life satisfaction, what are the variables for life satisfaction?
Well, life satisfaction is a scale. It's an 18-item scale. It's a measure. It's a measure. It has 18 separate items, and it has four different subdomains. So those 18 items are divided into four categories. So as it was written, it's work, it's satisfaction with social life, it's present your living situation, and it's about social situation and self and present life.
I see. The four categories under that.
Yes.
Label.
Right. So a lot of statisticians have done factor analysis, and these are four factors if you look at it deeply.
Cerebral cancer screening, but there are young women who aren't receiving it. Are they not seeking? And I can't tell you what. Are they not seeking it, or are the providers that they go to for their family planning, whatever it is, a pill or whatever, that might be an opportunity too. Those
yes,
providers
really
should say, "Hey, have you had your pap smear in the last couple of years?" And if not, they should refer.
Yeah, that's a really interesting subgroup because they have the lowest rate. You have really.
Yeah, you bet. I mean, that's a real observation.
Sure.
Yep, we're working. The goal is by Friday we'll submit them somewhere, so I soon, hopefully.
Well, let's have one last. Oh, do you have a question?
I have two questions, if I could, for
absolutely, absolutely.
One is, I wonder if your 6.5 percent utilization group, the ones that were not going to the GYN, does that group capture people who were not going to doctors at all, or does it just—it's just people going to primary care physicians?
Right. So those there were 83,000 women in my total sample.
Uh-huh.
So the sample had 105,000. 83,000 of them never went to a GYN. They could have gone to another provider. Okay?
I see.
And the 6.5% of those received cervical cancer screening. Just 6.5%. So the big punchline is right. If you went to a GYN during the year, there was about 21,000 of those, and 70% of them got their pap smear.
And
okay,
so you didn't, not included in those groups were people who didn't go to the doctor at all.
If you didn't go to the doctor at all, but you were enrolled in Medicaid for 12 months, you were part of my sample. Okay? So that 83,000 could have been women who went to other doctors, or it could have been women who were never went to the doctor.
Yeah.
That's possible.
And then I just had a comment for your just depression study. I appreciate you doing that.
Thanks.
My husband has suffered some depression after I've gotten better and his role has changed. Okay, and I'm not sure what the correlation to that is, but the back didn't show anything, but your list of symptoms just rings true.
anecdotally, I'll tell you, when I would tell people what I was doing my dissertation research on, a lot of women would feel very validated about spouses, brothers, parents, something, and a lot of men would say, there's no such thing. Like, we don't know what you're talking about.
But yeah.
Anecdotally, the relationship between men and women is one of the driving forces for why I was interested in this research in the first place.
Good.
Yeah.
So I have a question for Lisa as well. Yeah. So you mentioned that since 1970, differential rates of depression between men and women have
Suicide has decreased, and for men, suicide rates have increased.
So, what are the theories?
The thoughts on that?
Yeah.
So some think that there must be underdiagnosed depression because we know that suicide is closely linked to depression, and so it's odd. So it's called the suicide paradox, that how can all these men not be depressed, but they're all killing themselves.
But why since 1970?
So I would hypothesize a lot of it, because I do think it's interested in social role changes and changing economies. So it would be interesting to see if it was related. Nobody that I know of has been able to directly link it to like more women entering the workforce and a change in gender roles and males' expectations. But I think you could make an argument, and it would be an interesting study.
That's just post Vietnam, mm-hmm. right?
Yep.
You could also make an argument for medication control being much better among being
women.
More likely to be diagnosed with medication control being much better. Treatment. The suicide rates down while men's diagnosis goes
untreated. Unmedicated.
So Prozac came online in what, 80-something?
82-ish, I think.
Okay.
Yeah. Do you have one more thing? No.
Great.
Those are actually good thoughts here, and the final explanation of why the rates have gone like this really probably is complex. We've got both services, and we've got environmental role changes. It'll be something you can do.
Yeah.
<Want
a career.
laughs> That's right. Well, thanks. Thank you again for staying till the very end, and we hope we see you next year.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you, everyone.